From a secret location somewhere in America, this is your Chill Pack
Hollywood
Hour.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Hi, everybody. It's Dean Haglund and
Phil Lairness
with your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, coming from the sub offices of Rational Exuberance.
But it's not sub. Sub means below, and we're actually
above. You're above. Right.
We are overlooking Tony Los Feliz.
That's right.
Tony Los Feliz sounds like a mobster.
That's right. Hey, Tony Los Feliz, where's my money?
We are actually in a very historic building.
True enough.
In Los Feliz.
Right.
This is a neighborhood dear to my heart that's just in the shadow of Griffith Park and
yes,
the Griffith Park Observatory.
Where Birth of a Nation was filmed in 1909.
The very first feature film, Intolerance, mm-hmm. was made here on this street when this was all a back lot.
I did not know
that.
And
the only residence in this entire part of the city was the building we are in right now.
Ah.
If you look into the office here, where a painting that you drew of Los Feliz is prominently displayed, that's where, of course, a Murphy bed once was. In this, because this was the residence hotel for the movie stars and their families.
Oh, look at that. And Cecil B. DeMille built his first house, as did Chaplin, not just blocks from here.
I see your C.B. DeMille and your Chaplin, and I raise you Boris Karloff and James Whale.
Come on.
As I will, actually, later in the show.
Fantastic.
When we get to what we're reading.
What a show we have.
We do have a show. We hope all the fathers out there had a fantastic Father's
it
Day.
It was Father's Day yesterday.
Yeah, did you talk to your dad?
I did.
Excellent. How's he doing?
Very good. His blood work is excellent, and he was enjoying a beer on the porch.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Wonderful, as I would expect. Either on the porch or out of the trunk, whatever. Knowing your dad a little bit as I do.
That's where your beers come from.
I had a really fun start to the weekend. I guessed co-hosted.
Oh, that's right.
Combat Radio.
You were taking Mark Ryan's position.
I could never
take his position.
Replace him. I could only succeed him, as Valeris says to Spock in Star Trek VI. The undiscovered country.
Undiscovered nemesis. Right.
Yes, Mark Ryan was at, I think, a convention.
Yeah.
So Ethan Dettenmeyer, our friend, who is the producer and host
yep.
of Combat Radio, upon which we have guested many times, he let me be the co-host and said that I could invite any guest I wanted. And so naturally, he said, you can have any guest on the show you possibly want. I said, a mid-1960s Sophia Loren. And then he said any contemporary guest
that you could possibly get on the phone that would come over.
That does not involve time travel as mastered by the residents of Domenher that we discussed on last week's show.
That's right.
So I invited our friend Tucker Smallwood.
Awesome. And how'd that go?
It was a lot of fun.
Yes.
And of course, Ethan loved talking to Tucker and was disappointed that, you know, they didn't even get to blues music. They didn't get to, you know, there's so much stuff.
So what, they just did Vietnam and...
Talked about acting, talked about movies, talked about Coppola, talked about Robert Zemeckis, talked about the play, Where the Great Ones Run.
Right.
And talked about, really, not too much of his combat experience, but his experience with the Soldiers Project and the charity work that he does. Because, of course, that's near and dear to Ethan's heart, because Combat Radio is so named in part because of the charity work that he's always been involved with
the military
and veterans. So that was good fun.
Smooth move.
And it gave me an opportunity to push a little project we launched on Kickstarter.
Our Kickstarter project. Very exciting. I'm about to re-blast that to everyone.
The reaction has been really quite heartening. I mean, really quite moving. What people have written to us about this. The name of the project is Hieroglyph of the Human Soul,
mm-hmm.
and it's a documentary that we are making about the art and philosophy of our friend Lee McCloskey, who
right.
is, of course, prominently featured in The Truth is Out There.
Yes, for those who've seen the documentary, you know his room to be fully painted, including the spines of many of the books in his library that actually correlate Well, you have to see it. I don't know if I'm explaining
And of course,
anything.
Yeah, Hieroglyph of the Human Soul is the name of his study mm-hmm. and what became of his study following 9/11/2001. In
right,
the wake of 9/11/2001, a creation was born. Of course, the film that we're doing, I think, is about, you know, more than just The Room. It's certainly about his art going back decades, about the evolution of his philosophy of spherical consciousness, and mm-hmm. also about the work that the Olindar Foundation for Emerging Renaissance
does as well. Right.
And perhaps the weekly salons and all these things. So there's very rich territory to mine, and for those of us who have been fortunate enough to participate in events there, it really seems like a wonderful way to be able to give back, to make sure that this knowledge and this, because it's so inspiring and so beautiful, that it's not lost, and that many more people can share in it than would ever be able to come and travel to Olindar.
Right. And as an artist, you know, I'm always inspired by the words he says about, you know, what are the stories you want to tell? What is it, who you are, and why the work you do reverberates out, like these pebbles in a pond, you know? There's so many things that he does that is so inspiring that I can't wait to have a full documentary on that.
So I will, of course, be posting the Kickstarter link on our ChillPack Hollywood website. Mm-hmm. But if anybody's listening to this and wants to check out while we're talking right now, go to Kickstarter. The name of the project is Hieroglyph of the Human Soul, H-I-E-R-O-G-L-Y-P-H, Hieroglyph of the Human Soul. Or if you put in Phil Lairness, you put in Lee McCloskey, you find the project.
Right. So easy.
You know, I heard from Jonathan Browning, and you'll remember Jonathan because he was my first assistant director on Appearances, the
Appearances,
short film.
Yes.
Great guy.
Totally.
And super talented filmmaker and actor. And he has directed several short films that have played hundreds of festivals all over the world. Multiple award-winning short filmmaker. He made what he's calling his first ever dramatic short, though I actually have found some of his work in the past to be incredibly touching and moving, and thought of it as a drama.
What did he think of it as?
And I think he thought of it as a comedy, and this I found really funny.
Oh, you're kidding.
But I guess, you know, it's funny because it is really authentic and it is really true and
right.
It is really surprising. And, you know, it's not like they were going for laughs or asking for laughs.
Right.
But it's called Walter, and it stars the wonderful actor Paul Dooley.
I know Paul Dooley. I've improvised with him. He's a great guy.
Great character actor.
Right.
And, I mean,
and
anybody who was allowed to improvise regularly had free reign to improvise in Robert Altman films.
He's an improviser. And I performed with him many times with the Second City alumni back at the Santa Monica Pier and now at the Salon over on Pico Street. And he also could improvise he would do these poetry stories.
Mm-hmm.
There would be like a poetry slam thing that he would improvise based on one suggestion that would sort of have rhyming schemes, but there would also be off-rhyme schemes, and it was like this amazing thing he did. It was really impressive. Also, little known fact, his wife wrote the book for Wicked.
Think I did know that.
Isn't that amazing? And she was over in Japan because they don't know The Wizard of Oz over there, so they had to retool the show for...
So you're telling me that's how Paul Dooley can afford to do the no-pay short film?
That's exactly how.
Because he's riding those wicked residuals.
There's a wicked residual coming in every week from somewhere in the world.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly.
So people can check that short out, and I hope they will. Screamingfrog.com, that's the name of their production company, Screaming Frog. I'll post
Paul
the
Dooley
link.
And he cast in a dramatic role, thinking that it wouldn't be funny.
Well, I don't know.
I
think to him it's a drama. But again, that doesn't mean that a drama can't be funny. Right.
And this is the whole thing about Second City, is that a lot of your comedy comes from deep emotional things that you give it, that those characters become so rich.
It's what I always say about kind of the tent poles to me of Woody Allen's career, not necessarily his high points, not his masterpieces, which might be Annie Hall and Hannah and Her Sisters, for example. But to me, the two that really kind of bracket his career in an interesting way are Manhattan mm-hmm. in 79, because it's where Woody Allen understood how to make a comedy that could nevertheless be powerfully dramatic and emotional. And then Crimes and Misdemeanors 10 years later, where he felt comfortable making a drama that was nevertheless incredibly funny.
Right. Lots of laughs in there.
So should we start speaking of, improv and all of this sort of stuff? Should we start with our live event of the week?
Let's start with our live event of the week.
The Chill Pack Hollywood live event of the week.
Nothing more live than an Anton Chekhov revival. Huh? Who's with me, people?
Who's with me? Come on, Anton Chekhov.
And this is actually becomes... I did not mean this to be an excellent segue, and yet it was.
Here we go.
Because when you think Chekhov, when you think Russian
literature,
you think of these plays, you think drama.
I do.
And yet Chekhov always thought he was writing comedies.
Did he really?
He really did. And the wonderful old story goes, and it's probably apocryphal, who knows, but, you know, two people are watching a production of Chekhov, and one of the persons says to the other one, you know, I thought you said this was a comedy. It's a Russian comedy. Only one person dies. So that is comedy in Russian drama. And indeed, in the production I saw, Ivanov, only one person dies. So therefore, it's a interesting play. I had a great time. I saw it at the Odyssey Theater. It was a co-production with the Evidence Room. And the great director, Bart DiLorenzo, directed it. And it was fascinating because during the intermission, I was absolutely unsure whether what I was seeing was working at all. I had no idea. I felt like this might be awful what I'm seeing, but I couldn't be sure.
What?
It was really an odd experience during intermission. And after seeing the second act, I said that to the director. I said, I loved it because I was sitting here at intermission, and I was not alone. There was a much smaller crowd in the second act than there was in the first act.
Walkouts because they...
In the center section, many people did not return. And they really missed out. What the director was telling me was, you know, Ivanov was Chekhov's first play.
Right.
And it's four scenes. And you actually can tell that he's learning how to write a play as the play goes on.
Oh, my God.
Each successive scene is better written and better constructed than the scene before.
How odd.
But in the second half, it occurred to me how the approach and how what made me not like it, in some ways kind of the modern choices of it, were nevertheless so incredibly appropriate because Chekhov wrote a play around a man who we would now say was suffering from clinical depression.
Ah.
And when your main character actually, authentically, has clinical depression, it defies the conventions of normal dramatic devices.
Right. You can't build on those
normal arc, absolutely.
Yeah, right. So
that was fascinating.
Huh.
And
so they adhered to that.
They adhered to it. However, the last scene... spoiler alert. Look, it's Russian drama. It's going to end in a death.
Uh-huh.
And it ends in a suicide.
Right.
Which is written to take place offstage.
Right.
The main character says, excuse me for a moment, goes and kills himself.
Yeah.
The director thought, well, that's not satisfying. So he redid it. And it has, not since the ending of maybe 8.5 or Knights of Cabiria, has there been an ending that is so audacious and yet so enlivening and just made me so glad I went to see this show.
Wow.
It was, words defy what they do, but the suicide, suffice it to say, leads to a dance number.
Now that reminds me of a play, a radical play we did in college, but it was a 1968 modernist play that was done in New York, and it was sort of just a real kitchen sink drama that ended with one of the characters being shot by a sniper from offstage. Like, there was like, it said gunshot, lead character dies, blackout, curtain. And you're like, There was like no, and it was this idea that fate and all of these things, you know, we are just dust in the wind kind of thing.
Right.
And we did this and we suffered the same thing because it was just, you know, with a gunshot sound effect, somebody falls over and then a blackout. And then it was like, no one even applauded at that point.
Right.
It was like, what happened? And this apparently was the same thing they experienced when it opened in New York on Broadway. And I could see by, I actually suggested, can't we just put the sniper on stage? And they go, no, that's too audacious. That would be...
Well, I got to tell you, in this, the audience didn't know to applaud until blackout, and then the lights came back up.
Oh, is that right?
And the dead man is now standing center stage taking a bow, at which point we started applauding.
Oh, my God.
It was fantastic.
Wow, that is awesome.
So there's your live event of the week.
I love that.
And I ran into... Denise Crosby
at
Odyssey Theater.
How great.
She's so lovely. Asked about you.
She did.
Yeah. And
did you say good things?
Absolutely. And we need to, we really need to have her be a guest. I mean, it's ridiculous that we.
This is stupid that we haven't.
It's just stupid.
Yes.
It's just stupid.
So, well, we got to bank some shows because I'm going to be out of town a lot. So.
Are you?
Well, you know, I think I dodged a bullet because it's not really a live event in a week, but I did a Skype audition for a sci-fi paranormal show where I would be trapped for 6 weeks in the Texas desert somewhere doing ghost hunting with the one or others. Now, I don't think I should do this show. It's a cable, it sounds like it's a disaster. It sounds like it's gonna be a horrible, horrible sci-fi reality show up there with the, you know, Mansquito versus Octoshark. And
well, certainly your enthusiasm for promoting the show does not recommend you.
Does not recommend me. Yes, clearly if the producers hear this now and they had me on the cusp, they will know not to cast me.
I do love when you phone in your auditions, though.
They suggested it. They said, we're doing it.
Why should it be any different than how you will be
do all my parts? Yeah, exactly.
We had a collective resolution each week to talk about what we're reading.
Yeah.
How's that running book?
Oh, spectacular. We just did 7 miles today along the river. My new running stance, I've changed my whole gait. And I did 9-minute miles. I'm under 9-minute miles now. Mm-hmm. And I am preparing. I'll say it here now. We haven't entered, but we're going to do the Long Beach Marathon in the first week of October.
Wow.
So now we have a very strict 18-week training regimen that will go 3 to 5 miles a day, plus longer on the weekends with different threshold levels. And
now, the whole resolution was that you were going to participate in next year's Los Angeles Marathon.
Yes, well, that's still going on.
And when is that?
That's in March.
So you're basically going to get to that point 6 months early.
I'm going to be 6 months early. But to be fair, Long Beach Marathon's a bit easier because it's all flat. You're along the beachfront, so there's no hills.
All right.
Los Angeles, you go through Silver Lake, and you got to get up into the Hollywood on Sunset, and then you come down through Santa Monica, and then it sort of flattens out as you get to Santa Monica. So there's a few more hills on the long Los Angeles Marathon. So that makes it that a little more difficult and screws up your time. So Long Beach will know for sure our base time.
So that book has been helping you.
It's been very helpful. And yes, we have been following. There's a lovely regiment in the back for someone who wants to do a marathon just to complete the marathon. This is also for elite runners, and it has very scientific and oxygen, blood, chemical levels, you know, all of that stuff is in there as well. But we are just following the last sections on how to complete a marathon and survive it. So
excellent.
Yes. So that book's going good.
I'm, of course, still reading the Boris Karloff
yes.
Authorized biography by Stephen Jacobs, Boris Karloff, More Than a Monster. And it inspired me to watch The Old Dark House, a 1932 film that reunited Karloff
yep.
with his Frankenstein director, James Whale.
James Whale,
and of course, they would work together again in Bride of Frankenstein.
Yeah, but this came in between that, right?
This came in between 1932, and it was Karloff got top billing. The rest of this cast, though, and it, the old dark house, you know everything you need to know about it. It's a big old spooky house on a stormy night.
And you have to spend the night to get the insurance or the...
no, not really, but the other cast... Gloria Stewart, young, lovely Gloria Stewart, who most people know as the old chick in Titanic.
Right.
Charles Laughton in his first screen role.
Come on.
Already excellent.
He played Henry VIII. He played Hunchback.
I mean, this is a man who has been called the greatest screen actor of all time.
And he did Mutiny on the Bounty. He was Captain Bligh.
So you have Witness for the Prosecution is one of my favorite.
Witness for the Prosecution as well. Laughton. Charles Laughton's great.
So who else is in this thing? One of my favorite, I consider him a screen villain, Raymond Massey.
Oh, yes.
Arsenic and Old Lace in the Karloff role. And in fact, Karloff would play the Karloff role in a remake of it in the 1960s.
Oh, awesome.
What else was Raymond Massey in? He was in a couple of the...
You know, and I read a Massey biography because he's Canadian.
Well, yeah, he's in 49th Parallel.
49th Parallel.
He's in a couple of the Michael Powell Pressburger films. In fact, he plays the prosecutor in Stairway to Heaven / A Matter of Life and Death.
Right, right.
And so he's such wonderful. Great, Raymond Massey was so great. And in this, he's kind of he's the heartthrob, which is sort of one of them. one of the heartthrobs. Also has, the kind of protagonist leading man in it, so charming and debonair, young Melvin Douglas.
Oh, my gosh.
And, of course, when I was a kid, Melvin Douglas was a very old man.
Yeah.
And doing the likes of Being There, which I just watched.
Just watched again with
Peter
Sellers.
So in the same week, I saw one of his last great roles and his one of his first great roles.
Isn't that amazing?
And he really had quite the career. And
no, I don't know this movie at all for Boris Karloff. This is a...
You know, I have a trouble with 1930s movies.
Really?
I really do. I have a hard time watching most of them. I mean, I like 39 Steps.
Yeah.
I like Lady Vanishes. Those are both Hitchcock movies.
Mm-hmm.
Hitchcock seemed to be one of those few directors who, following the advent of sound, worked out pretty quickly how to make movies cinematic.
Right.
It
stopped from just listening to
making it was a little tough. And James Whale... brings some really nice devices into play to create tension and atmosphere in this. But there's a little bit of like 1930s, especially the first half of 1930s for me, that I can't really get wrapped up in the story of the film. I see the evolution of the language of cinema.
Right.
You know, they had mastered it, and now they kind of had to go back to square one and start again.
Well, because...
So there's that period that's tough for me to really enjoy these movies.
Because it was tough to make those films. When you realize that the camera made sound,
right.
So they had to build these boxes with a clear glass window and put the camera inside that and then run the sound separate from the camera, and then you couldn't move that camera, so you had to know your blocked-off shot.
How about this? I'm reading about some of these things, and you know, you hear about, like, even back then, production shoots going over schedule, and the final day of shooting being 2 weeks before the film premiered. And they didn't push the premiere.
Oh, you're kidding.
And they still had to score it, and they still had to edit it, and they still had to do... And they edited it the old way, but you know what there was no talk of? Post-sound work. They weren't building sound effects. They weren't.
That's right.
Unless something was critically needed. So that's one of the reasons also it's hard for me to watch these films, because it's this weird combination of talky but still silent.
Yeah.
Like, why am I not hearing footsteps? Why am I not hearing... Why is that door slam silent?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then we just watched something. It was an action film. And we saw it recently. I wish I remember the title of this. But it was basically a silent film where they dubbed over a lot of the dialogue, and then just the key gunshot, car driving away, door slamming was added in post, but the rest of it was silent. So you didn't hear any of the footsteps running around, you didn't hear the motor running. Like, all of these things were oddly vacant from the movie.
Another thing that came up for me in reading this Boris Karloff book was interesting, because there's been a lot of news lately about the pressure in the film industry today to kowtow to Chinese censors.
Oh, yes.
I heard about this. In order to get distribution in China, you know, one of the things that's happening, for example, is you will no longer see quite so many Asian villains.
Right. They just re-edit 3 minutes of
that movie. And to a degree, I think that that can be okay. I mean, it's a tricky thing. You know, you're always talking about, you know, look, the biggest threat to freedom of speech, let alone artistic freedom of expression, is going to be commerce.
Yeah.
Right? We don't really have to worry about
censorship.
Government censorship much. It's really about commerce. It's about these big, you know, multinational corporations. And they are prone to this kind of pressure. And to a degree, you know what? Like anything, it's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's just a thing.
Right.
And if we're saved from more stereotyped and perhaps racist portrayals, hey, good for the economic force.
Let's do that.
On the other hand, like reading this this Karloff biography, he played one of his first good guy roles that he played, and I love that it's an inmate on Devil's Island, but it was in the movie Devil's Island. He was wrongfully convicted to Devil's Island, character that he was playing, and it was about, you know, this harrowing depiction of what Devil's Island, that penal colony, the French penal colony was like.
Mm-hmm.
And France was not happy. So France, after it started to get released, not only would they boycott it in their own country, but they said to Universal, if you continue to show this film in the U.S., we will never, ever let a Universal picture into France ever again.
And that was a big population.
So Universal yielded. And after it played in Los Angeles, it didn't play anywhere else.
Are you kidding?
Until war in Europe broke out in 1939, and by 1940, Universal said, you know what, I think the French have their hands full. Let's release it in New York. And then they released it 2 years later, and it got good reviews here and everything.
Oh, interesting.
But they bowed to foreign pressure because France didn't like having their dirty laundry about Devil's Island air.
Right.
So this is an ongoing thing. This will always be a thing. You're looking for expanded markets and more money. And
how economies shift and who becomes, you know, the who has more money to invest, then that becomes the issue.
Have you seen any movies?
I saw... you know what I saw? HBO had the free weekend, so we recorded a bunch of stuff. And I saw Ice Harvest, half of it.
What was that?
That was John Cusack, Oliver Platt, and Billy Bob Thornton. And the opening scene is they rob a bank for $2 million, and then they just have to play cool for that night before they skip.
Are we really going to spend time talking about a movie you've seen half of? Are you going to watch the second half?
No, I don't think I am. That's the thing.
Well, there you go. Ice Harvest.
Yeah.
So you haven't seen the Prometheus yet?
No. I'm dying to see the Prometheus.
I talked about it last week. And we're going to talk about it again. But I also saw Men in Black 3.
You did?
Yeah. And I'm a little bit surprised by the rather... It's got great box office around the world, but kind of the lackluster reception it got in this country.
Yeah.
It's certainly better than the second one, and it was quite enjoyable.
And
I thought the time travel storyline was wonderfully pleasing.
And this is Josh Brolin's great impersonation of
uncanny.
Is it?
It's really uncanny. Yeah. He has captured him.
And he spent a lot of time listening to him, trying to work out the R's and the M's and
it's really something.
He really nailed it.
And
apparently that's the only reason to go to the movie.
Well, no, I think it's very funny. Jemaine Clement from Flight of the Conchords plays the villain.
Oh, really?
And he's hilarious.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
I didn't know it either.
How come he's not being promoted? Flight of the Conchords is like this huge...
I know.
Why aren't they
There has got to be a big screen movie of Flight of the Conchords. They have got to do that.
I think they were working on it.
Jemaine Clement is doing big movies, and Brett McKenzie, of course, won an Oscar last year, his partner in Flight of the Conchords, for writing the songs for The Muppets.
The Muppets, yeah.
I would hope so. But I'm, you know, surprised that it wasn't better received. I mean, there's...
I guess it was buried in between...
But so many of these movies have been underperforming until Madagascar 3 and Prometheus. Now, Prometheus has really, you know, set off a lot of debate.
Yes.
And I spoke to this a little bit last week about how when you're watching the movie, there really is the sense that you're watching three movies. You're watching a prequel to Alien, you're watching a sequel to Alien, and you're watching another science fiction movie that has nothing to do with Alien at all. And when you think back to the fact that when Ridley Scott was describing what he was going to be doing, and in one interview he said it has nothing to do with Alien, and another one he said it's in the universe of Alien, but it doesn't have anything to do with it, and then in another one he said it's a direct prequel, that you kind of got the sense that maybe he wasn't even sure.
Right.
Now, he's getting off, if you'll pardon the expression, since it's the name of his production company, scot-free, in the criticisms for this, and the writer is really taking the slack. But it seems to me that when the director, who's the 800-pound gorilla on this, has what we, you know, could say was ambivalence, at least expressed in these interviews, that's a hard thing to write for.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the film does work as a prequel, and it does work to set up a whole new line of movies.
Yeah.
Prometheus 2 will have, I'm sure, nothing to do with the Alien franchise. It'll have to do with this other franchise, and it could be a better film. There's no question that it could be a better film than this, but this could launch a very good series. Mm. But I was struck by this for a couple of reasons, because some listeners of our show really have trashed it. Some have really loved it. And, you know, I do the midweek drive on Siren FM almost every week. Didn't do it this last week, but... Lily Holloman took my place, and though she could only succeed me, never replace me. But Alex Lefchuk actually ripped up reviews on the air and said, "Sometimes you just have to do this, you know." And
he ripped them up, like tore them to pieces.
Yeah, in an interview with her about something else. But I thought, you know, we have many critics who listen and contribute to this show, so I was just curious about Prometheus.
Okay.
To see what some of their reactions might be. Starting with our friend Matty Giles,
right,
who is now writing Matt Giles Movie Files.
Mm.
And you can find his reviews at mattgilesmoviefiles.blogspot.com. Of course, we'll run that link.
Yep.
And just a couple of his comments about Prometheus. And it's a very nice review. And again, a very nice review because it gets into the issues of it without, again, spoiling anything. Always
See, that's
a nice
my
trick.
Problem. I'm Mr. Spoiler King.
He goes, yes, the script needs work. Yes, the film's tone is mix-matched at certain points. And yes, there will never be a way to replicate that same feeling of dread that Alien created all those years ago.
Right.
But it's because of Scott's acceptance of that fact and willingness to try something new that I enjoyed Prometheus.
Hmm.
Fassbender's performance, its homages to 2001 and Star Trek, intended or not, and its philosophical questions, answered or not, make it an interesting addition to the science fiction genre and also worthy of its own subcategory somewhere between Ridley Scott, Stanley Kubrick, and Gene Roddenberry.
Wow.
So very nice. I looked to our friend Josh Glasgow at Glasgow to the Movies. He decided to take this opportunity to revisit Alien and did not actually review Prometheus.
Okay.
The independent critic who was very kind to our film, The Truth Is Out There.
Yes, I remember.
Gave us an A rating. He began, it's a very interesting review, Prometheus is a masterpiece.
What?
A visually stunning film with eye-popping yet non-distracting 3D imagery woven together into the fabric of a story that simultaneously confounds and astounds and balances characters both intriguing and appealing. But Prometheus is also a disappointment, an overreaching film with a high-tech flea market sort of a feeling that really, really tries to blend together substantial metaphysics with sci-fi horror only to achieve decidedly mixed results. He concludes with, Prometheus entertained me. That's good. But I can't deny it. I was hoping for more. It's kind of like scratching for the meaning of life and finding out the answer really is 42.
Wow.
Finally, Luke Y. Thompson, who's a two-time guest on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
And winner of the
Online Critic Award, writes for the website formerly known as Geek Chic Daily, now The Nerdist.
The Nerdist, yep.
So is this the film you wanted? If you were hoping for deep, dark visuals by Scott in 3D, a story involving the mysterious space jockey, or a goth take on 2001 and 2010 combined, this delivers. If you wanted a James Cameron-style action movie, It doesn't.
Right.
Do you like movies that don't spoon-feed everything, leaving a few loose ends up for discussion, or do you hate when stories leave things dangling? In fairness, this story is reasonably complete, even with gratuitous sequel tease, but it certainly leaves many possibilities open, such as the reason for life on Earth. I like what I think the film's implying in that department, but can't be sure. Prometheus is stellar slasher sci-fi for the cerebral gorehound.
Wow.
That's me. Is it you? What a great review that is.
Am I a cerebral gorehound? Boy, I got to think about that.
And that's what's wonderful. I liked doing this because these are three men who have individual voices and they're following their own voices.
Right.
They're not trying to be any other critic. And, but if you can find yourself in a review, that can be very helpful in terms of using it as a guide.
Yeah.
But it's also very useful in saying, okay, this is where the critic's coming from.
Yeah.
So it was fun.
So that's Prometheus. So this is neat that Ridley Scott is actually, it seems that he actually stretched. When a time when he could sort of coast, it seems that he actually was exploring something artistic in a huge, major...
It almost, and maybe this is the problem... It's almost like he wanted to explore these issues and thought the only way he was going to be able to do it on a big enough canvas is if it was in the Alien universe. Like that gave him permission.
It's true, because you know, a Black Hawk Down that was his, wasn't that his?
Yeah.
That was a Scott Free. To me, that was, he was limited by the story itself. So he had to adhere to the historical details. And it actually limited his ideas.
I think the fact that he has announced that Blade Runner 2 will be a direct sequel is a good sign. I mean, I think it makes it clear that he knows where he wants to go.
And he's got
an idea. Has to be all about the bigger ideas that are being expressed in a movie like
that. Yeah, absolutely.
At least based on Prometheus. I mean, that's one of the interesting things about Prometheus is it might have been disappointing in certain ways for me that these critics address, like not as scary as that first Alien, but how could it be?
Yeah.
But it also left me really looking forward to Blade Runner 2.
Yeah. I know. Though, as we discussed, I still think there should be a prequel to Blade Runner of how L.A. became the
anti-radioactive
area.
And you could even try to explain away the fact that it 2020 is coming and we're not there yet.
We're not there
yet. So you could create an alternate timeline.
Totally.
Do like a J.J. Abrams Star Trek kind
of
thing.
Totally. Wouldn't that be awesome?
You know, you mentioned, we said we were going to talk about the television a little bit this week.
Yes.
You said you got the free HBO weekend.
Yes.
Have you managed to check out Julia Louis-Dreyfus's Veep?
We have it recorded, but I have not seen it. I heard it's fun.
This is really fun. I mean, this might be the best role she's ever been given.
Right. She's the vice president.
We watched all 8 episodes in fairly quick succession. To me, the most important player on it is Tony Hale, the guy who played the brother in Buster in Arrested Development.
Yeah.
He's a national treasure.
Yeah, he sure is. He's great at that, actually.
But I really hope there's a second season. This is, political satire's really
tough.
Difficult.
Yeah.
And this is a show where you really don't know whether the vice president is Republican or Democrat.
Right.
There's one episode, one conversation where immigration and senators from Arizona are in it and they have to reach across the aisle, and that makes one maybe believe that they must be Democrat because the Arizona's from senators are probably Republican. But immigration is one of those things where you never know what side anyone's going to come
down on. Yeah, exactly.
Down on. But it's so great because it really isn't about any kind of right or left agenda or the differences between it. It really is more or less about how just screwed up this system is and how it brings out the worst in everybody.
It's true, right? And I really like that, you know, in a time now when political mockery, how do you satire something that's so mocked and so satirical, that's so ridiculous? Like, to me, the whole political system without any commentary in and of itself is ridiculous. So that to then go and make fun of it, then, you know, you have to go so far outside the realm of realism that you would lose.
And I think what they're getting to is, and at its best, it feels authentic. It almost feels like maybe this is what it's like.
Yeah.
Not to the degree of verisimilitude that Larry Sanders achieved.
Right. No, but it's West Wing. To me, it's like a West Wing. It's a more real version of West Wing.
Right.
Because West Wing was like, oh, we got to do good. And like,
well, it led with its politics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Whereas this seems to lead with its humanity, which is where...
Oh, yeah, or lack thereof.
Or lack thereof, yeah.
Speaking of which, you know, Aaron Sorkin has a new HBO show coming on that I can't wait to see.
This Newsroom thing?
Newsroom, because I am a big Jeff Daniels
Yeah,
fan.
That's going to be
and
interesting.
And it seems like a really good character for him.
Yeah. I read some early sides on that, and I wasn't keen on what I read, but I'm hoping that he... pulls it out of the bag.
So I'm looking forward. I have no way to judge it.
Yep.
I mean, the promos are artfully cut together and entertaining. But I am looking forward to that. There's another HBO show that Lily watches called
really?
Girls from Lena Dunham, who
she's
made the
24.
Movie Tiny Furniture.
Yeah. How do you get a series when you're 24? I tried to pitch when I was 24. I didn't get shit.
Well, Tiny Furniture is a really nice piece, that
oh,
film
it?
That she made. And I guess she made a fan of Judd Apatow.
Yeah.
And so he's the co-producer of this
right,
show.
Right, so he could bring it in.
One, you know, it's people mostly in their 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's very little that I find less interesting. There goes half our listenership.
But hey, old man.
Exactly. I mean, it's just... But really, if I were to be a little more honest with you than that, it's just... It's so authentic that it's too painful for me to...
Right. You know all these people.
I have to keep my head... No, I don't know if I necessarily know them, but I know that this is... True. I know that this is... I mean, there's... Like, one scene, for example, she interviews for a job, and everything's going great until it's not going great. And when you see it not going great, it's just... It makes you cringe so much.
And that's what I understand the show. I have so many cringe moments.
Yeah. And so just... I have to be doing something else while the show's on.
See?
Yeah.
Interesting. Because to me, The Office, with the British BBC series, started that whole cringe... A cringe is entertainment. I don't know, was that where it happened? But the whole idea of
Maybe.
Just setting up cringe moments for
now,
your
who characters. Started that? Who was responsible?
Was it The Office? Okay. Or maybe Larry Sanders even.
Larry Sanders did that,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I guess so. But the yeah, were those cringeworthy or they were just sort of hilarious because you didn't like any of them?
I don't know.
Yeah, it was like these cringe moments where you're like...
Well, that is true. You're not necessarily rooting for them in the same way, so it isn't. I mean, it
yeah.
is... It is
where you make somebody likable and then they go into a horrible situation.
Exactly.
And then you're like cringing for them. And then you're laughing at the uncomfortableness. It becomes this whole... Dear God.
Well, I think... I still think that that's something that Mad Men manages to pull off in a dramatic way.
It is dramatic because it's true. That's not comedic at all.
No,
and it is cringe moment.
Sure. It really is, mm-hmm. And because it's so true,
yeah,
it still makes it. Something that makes me cringe,
cringe,
twinge,
and twitch,
and cringe. Twitch,
the twitch.
Do we need not one but two television series based on Silence of the Lambs? Do we really? NBC has a Hannibal Lecter TV series.
Do they?
With Mads Mikkelsen, who you know I love, the villain in Casino Royale,
yeah.
and a star of After the Wedding. He's playing
Hannibal Lecter?
Hannibal in the NBC series Hannibal.
So he's just eating a different person every week?
Who will he eat this week? Oh my God, it's Love Boat meets Iron Chef.
Smiles, everyone, smiles. This week, who's this boss? Why, he's delicious. And he's, you know, a banker from Akron, Ohio, who's here to be eaten.
But then there's always the dark side to his fantasy, right? There's always, then there's got to be, you know.
His fantasy is to be a rock and roll star that I eat.
That's what? My friend Sully, stand-up comic, he used to always do a piece about that, about, you know, his fantasy is to wear one of the suits we wear, you know, but then it turns dark. But he might find the dry cleaning bills are more
to be
than
more
he thought they would
have
yeah,
to be.
Exactly. Oh, and then there's Mr. Work patting tattoo and that gigantic head.
Totally.
Lifetime, not to be outdone.
Oh, good.
Has a Clarice series coming on.
Well, yeah. See, now I'd be more apt to watch the FBI girl than the
series. So my question,
killing.
Though, is how long...
Before those two shows cross?
Well, don't they have to?
Yes.
Or don't they have to at some point have Clarice Starling... I mean, if the ratings stumble at all, they're going to need to introduce Hannibal Lecter, at least during sweeps...
So you mean Lifetime has to bring in Hannibal Lecter?
Well, but they might. NBC... Do they bring in their own, or do they do a crossover?
I would think they do a crossover because you're.
Is it the same parent company? I don't know. Lifetime, NBC.
No, it's not. No. I don't think. But
that would become tough.
It would be tough, but I'm sure you would work that out.
Well, I guess X-Files did it.
We did, right. Yeah, we had Richard Belzer.
But then Richard Belzer, we didn't know this at the time, but of course his contract with television was that he would get to play that character on every network and every show ever produced.
He does hold the world's record for that character being in 4 different TV series, which is pretty amazing.
Speaking of television, as soon as we're done recording this installment of your Chillback Hollywood Hour...
I am dreading.
Something called Payback.
Ouch!
You finally will be making good on your Oscars bet.
That I lost by 1 category.
No, I don't think so. I think I pretty much cleaned
the
floor.
No, you did not.
I think maybe 1 category was last year. It was one of the many years I beat you. Was
by 1 category.
Like that makes it less sweet. I don't know. You know what? Once I knew I was going to win, I phoned in the other category. Here's the thing. We're going to be watching the pilot episode of Twin Peaks.
Yeah, which I've never seen.
And during commercials or bathroom breaks, I'm going to be interviewing you.
But I've been to the location twice.
I know you have.
Because I've been in the backseat of you driving, and you take us out of the way every time we're near Seattle.
You celebrated my birthday with me in the town of Twin Peaks.
Totally.
What a good sport you are. Like you had a choice.
Like I had a choice.
Like I didn't arrange the flights. I made you take a later flight so that we could do that. All right.
That's true.
I made you reschedule your flight.
This is horrible.
All right. We had a lawsuit of the week that we didn't get time to do last week, and I'm so disappointed because I was anticipating it. It was about to become a lawsuit. It hadn't been announced yet.
Right.
And then we didn't have time for it. And so then, Nikki Fink gets to break the story. I was that close to being able to tweet to Nikki Fink, told ya!
The Chillpack Hollywood Lawsuit of the Week.
Zhang Ziyi, the star of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, is now laying out lawsuits left and right to defend her good name.
Right.
Against the charges that have kept her from being able to travel outside of China recently. Namely, that she has earned $64 million or something like that by literally prostituting herself to a string of powerful Chinese men.
What?
Among those with whom the actress was alleged to have had sex for money is a disgraced politician Bo Zhilai, am I pronouncing this right?
I'm sure.
Who was ousted from China's powerful Politburo amid allegations that he and his wife were involved in the murder of a very powerful businessman.
Right, I remember that story. Yeah, that was a good one. But wait, go back. She made $64 million doing prostitution?
This is what I'm saying is I figured she would probably be suing over this. But she did get her passport pulled because these charges are being investigated she's basically a high-paid prostitute, in addition to being, oh, by the way, one of the most BAFTA award-nominated and recognized actresses of all time. She's a huge movie star. We know her best for Crouching Tiger and Hidden Dragon, but she's a huge movie star. And, by the way, only 33 years of age.
Right.
Still in the prime of her acting career.
So my question goes back to the dollar sum, $64 million. Yeah. Where did that come from?
I found another one that's $70 million. And I don't know, is that yen? Is that dollars? Is it euros? What does it matter? When you start throwing around million and prostitute in the same thing, it must be sweeps week.
So somebody had to come up with that dollar sum to go, well, you got this from prostitution as opposed to residuals.
Well, specifically in this investigation with Bo, Mr. Bo, according to reports in China, she slept with him at least 10 times between 2007 and 2011 in exchange for huge monetary gifts.
Uh-huh.
The secret trysts are alleged to have taken place in Beijing and more than a million each time they took place.
Wow.
Yeah. However, as The New Yorker pointed out, there's reasons to be very cautious here
about
promoting these allegations, especially given how many enemies Bo himself has.
Yes.
That guy
clearly
has.
Clearly that's somebody out to get.
And also, oh, by the way, how many detractors she has.
Oh, I don't...
Because she's a powerful, independent young woman.
Oh, I see.
That's and so there are many, me. Many conservative and traditional voices that would seek to slander her.
That's horrible.
And
what is slander? But you know what? Here's the thing. I don't think it's slanderous to say you made $64 million prostitution. That would say, hey, you're really good.
Oh my.
See, to say you made like $30 or something, that's horrible.
Wow. It's not, right, it's not the occupation. You're not someone who ever judges anyone by their occupation. You want to know what the critics think.
Oh, that's horrible.
Anyway, she said that these are lies, they're contemptuous
yes.
lies. Whatever the cost, I will seek legal recourse and pursue this matter to the very end. And this brings up a whole issue, though, that has nothing to do with America at all. But apparently a shocking amount of power has fallen into the hands of the blogging culture in China. So news, there really isn't a lot of reliable news gathering going on
right.
in China anymore.
Nobody's double-checking
so much their facts. Of this is on the internet
and
is through bloggers. And one of the shocking results of this is they have a real conspiracy culture there.
Yeah,
conspiracy theory culture there.
Absolutely.
We, of course, we don't know anything about that.
Right. But my point, this is to me more amazing that you get your passport pulled based on not really news or facts or anything like that, but the blogging culture itself can go out and just sort of go...
Where there's smoke, there's fire.
Where there's smoke, and it's just like we create a lot of smoke, and suddenly I can't travel because my passport's pulled because 60 bloggers say...
I can't speak to how free and open a society China is to begin
right.
with, so it
you
know.
Would think that would be... Shutting it down?
Yeah, I mean, that may pose part of the problem. But anyway, so Zhang Ziyi suing to prove that she's not a prostitute. What better lawsuit of the week?
I agree.
Finally, celebrity deaths. We'll close with celebrity deaths.
Very good.
Celebrity deaths.
You know, it was 20 years ago in April that we had the Rodney King riots
yes,
here in
it
Los
was.
Angeles. Where were you when the Rodney King riots
I
were
was
taking
in Vancouver.
Place?
Vancouver.
Yeah? Riots there?
There were no... Yeah, we just riot during the Stanley Cup.
No, but there were none.
There were none.
Because I was in Washington State, rural Washington State, when the verdict was announced.
Yeah.
And I almost drove off the side of the road because I could not believe... I mean, I didn't follow the case. We all saw the video, which seemed to be pretty good proof.
Evidence, yeah. What more do you need?
But what I could not believe was, did this, you know, I mean, I just drove off the side of the road and said, did this jury not understand the what's going to go down now?
Yeah.
And, of course, by that night, I had made it to Seattle, and riots had started in Los Angeles. Ultimately, 55 would be dead.
Yeah.
No, so the next day I flew out of Seattle, and the next day riots broke out in Seattle.
Yes.
And
there
then,
are other cities.
And then I went to San Francisco, and the day I left there, so I was leaving
a trail
of devastation in my wake. But yeah, 55 people died in the L.A. Rodney King riots. Anyway, this morning Rodney King was found dead, or yesterday morning.
Yesterday morning.
Rodney King was found dead in the swimming pool, 47. I think we can effectively refer to Rodney King as a celebrity.
Can we? Yeah, I guess so. He's
kind of a household name.
We knew who he was.
And certainly he was used, interestingly enough, as kind of, for a while, a go-to punchline in jokes. Remember how often that would be like the shortcut joke about
hey Rodney King
or life in Los Angeles or police behavior. So there you go. What
there
an interesting way to end another installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. I think what we're saying, people, is can't we all just get along? that was his thing.
That
right?
was his,
that was his thing. Yeah. Can't we all just get along?
Can we all just get along to stop the rioting?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I guess it helped. Because the rioting soon stopped after
Certainly,
that.
We have not had
a riot since then.
We haven't?
Well.
I guess we haven't.
No. The Lakers
riots. Yeah, sure.
So every time the Lakers
But that's
win.
A celebration.
Yes, we celebrate by burning down the town.
There was no L.A. King riots.
There was none.
Good. good.
But there was also a really strict police attention, and they were shooting off a couple rubber bullets and tear gas on 7th Street a couple times, just to, like, you know, tell the crowd, hey, go home.
People can find more than 100 installments of their Chillpack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. They can download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Leave a review on iTunes.
Do that.
Why not?
And you can subscribe via a really simple syndication.
So easy.
You can also like the show on Facebook.
Like us?
You didn't say please like us. I actually got some messages from people that say that, like...
They like the
they like how
like
you
us?
Say, please like us.
Please like us.
Yeah. You can also, if you like us on Facebook, facebook.com/chillpackhollywood, you'll find a tab on the page that allows you to listen to all our shows right there on Facebook.
How cool is that?
You can find the most recent show and listen to it every week on MySpace, where we always have a blog previewing the following week's show. We're still there. We are going to be, like we said, the last people out the door turning off the lights and locking up. When the party is finally over.
Remember that, Rupert Murdoch. We will be supporting your...
MySpace.com/ChillpackHollywood.
Or did he sell that? He sold it already.
Follow us on Twitter.
Yes, I'm at D. Haglin.
I'm at Phil Larenas. And...
next week, we'll be shooting some of the my comments.
Maybe
my
we'll
pithy
do.
Comments,
we'll see. We'll
my pithy
see
comments from this Twin
well,
Peaks
we
episode.
Well, we use this Twin Peaks. We'll see how we're going to do.
Okay, awesome.
Because there will be drinking involved.
Yes, that's always an entertaining
thing. And... but write us.
Yes.
And we will certainly talk about whatever it is you want us to talk about.
Because we love
it
that.
Is your Chillpack Hollywood Hour. Write us chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Till next week, I'm Phil Larenas.
I'm Dean Haglin.
Bye.
Belated spoiler alert.